Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
So, Jim, what have you been doing lately when you haven't been on the show?
Well, Patrick, I discovered this new thing that I really enjoy.
Oh, yeah? What's that? Windsurfing? Crypto mining? Model train building?
No. More radical than any of that. Reading. Okay, Patrick, we're going to do something different here on this episode.
Okay.
It might be a little bit uncomfortable for people, all right? Get them ready for that. So this show is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And normally, we you're the one who talks about books you've read.
Right.
You have a whole thing. It's Patrick's Book Nook, right? It's literally right. In the title is your name. So
that's
I don't know
right.
If I'm gonna request entry into the Book Nook.
Okay.
Will you grant that?
Granted.
Jim's.
Special place to be.
Jim's.
He reads music history.
Hey, welcome to the Book Nook. Look. We have books, and over there, another book, and right over there, it's,
Jim.
Kindle?
Jim's. 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 Jim's.
Because I was just on vacation and I read this book and I just thought maybe we could talk about it for a little bit. It's this book here. It's called Passion is a Fashion, The Real Story of the Clash by Pat Gilbert. All right. Have you ever seen this before? Have you read this book?
I have seen that book. I don't believe I read it, but I have seen it. Yeah.
This guy, Pat Gilbert, he writes for Mojo magazine.
Okay. Okay.
So he's a journalist in the UK.
Okay.
Let's see. This came out in 2004. Copyright 2004, Pat Gilbert. Okay. Shortly after Joe Strummer's death, this came out. Okay. Book. Okay. So the book is, you know, as advertised, The Real Story of the Clash. It's just a, you know, it's a basic, you know, band bio kind of thing, right? History of this band.
Right.
There have been other books written about the Clash. This isn't the only one out there.
Right.
There have been a couple of documentaries you can find. There's been a podcast series that I've listened to.
Yeah.
And I think you have as well. So,
yep.
This not like this is the only place to find, you know, the story of the Clash. Now, this one,
right.
Of course, says the real story, but I don't think I've read any of the other books, so I don't have that to compare it to.
Okay.
I will just say real quickly, this is not necessarily based on long interviews with the band members. He did get interviews with each of the band members.
Okay.
He did his reporting on this before Joe died.
Okay.
But he writes a little bit in first person about each of the accounts of meeting these people. And it wasn't necessarily the first time he'd met them, because I mentioned he's a music journalist. So, but he, you do get the sense in here that you know for sure he spent some time talking with each band member separately for this book, but you don't get the sense it was like long, like, you know, days on end,
right?
Going
right.
on and on. You know, it's like meeting them
yeah.
at like a pub for, you know, your standard kind of like journalist interview kind
right.
of thing, right?
Got it.
But so you do get their perspective in here on things, but he did a really good job of interviewing the many, many, many people in the Clash camp.
Okay.
Right? There are so many, Patrick. I think you know this, right? But
yeah.
It, you know, the thing about the Clash was, I guess about, 8 years or so that they were a band, there were just people constantly coming in and out of
yeah.
the, you know, of the group. Not of the group itself, but you know, surrounding them, right? Managers and people who worked for them doing, you know, I don't know, publicity or driving, you know, their driver, or, you know,
yep.
they had all these people, you know, in their, you know, what it takes to
road crew. Yeah.
The road crew, all these people. Yeah. There's one guy named Rodent, right?
Rodent. So anyway, yes.
but none of these people, it just seemed like nobody really stuck on for very long. So you've got all these people, you know, because it was, as described here, somewhat of a chaotic operation.
Yeah.
And so,
right. Yes.
So anyway, the point is there's a lot of people who have a lot of information, a lot of perspectives on things that could be interviewed, and they're all in here, right?
Yep.
I would say from a reader standpoint, sometimes it could get a little bit hard to follow who all these people are. So you kind of at some point have to just get over that. Like, you know, somebody comes back in and tells some story and you're like, who was this person again? I don't really remember. Now, some of them have really interesting names like Rodent and Cosmo Vinyl and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So you can remember those people.
Yeah.
There's one guy named Robin Banks, which, you know, is kind of funny, right? And there's all that, right? But here's what I will say. As a fan of this band, and we've talked about The Clash in the past.
Yes.
You know, what drew me initially, I think, to them, and I didn't really... just a really quick backstory on my own fandom here is that, you know, I probably the first I heard The Clash at all was their stuff from Combat Rock, which came out in the early 80s and had videos on MTV. So Rock the Casbah, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Probably like the first big two. And those even got, as I recall, I think they got radio airplay in the United States. Like,
absolutely. Yeah.
That
Rock
was
the
a
Casbah.
Hit.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a hit album. So I got.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that that was my introduction, which was their last album. I'm not counting the one that they did with other people. That's mentioned in this book briefly, but let's just discount that for a moment.
Yeah.
You know, the last Strummer Jones Clash album.
Yes.
Right. And so then when I went to college, that's where I sort of then got more exposed to the Clash and got the debut album and London Calling and all that stuff. Right. So.
Right.
But I think initially what really interested me in the band was probably the music first. It was just so like powerful and tight and diverse, like, you know, all these interesting, you know, all these reggae influences and all this other stuff. Right. So it was just very compelling. And then, of course, you start to then listen to what, you know, Joe's singing about. Right. And then you get into that. And what is all this? And it just seems so like there was so much to explore there, right? It was such an interesting band. You could go as deep as you want, right, with this band, right?
Absolutely.
I think it makes for a great story because there's so much behind the scenes stuff that is just so compelling. You know, how did this all come together? How did a band like this even come together, right? So I will say a couple things. This book is front loaded with background.
Okay.
So you get about maybe almost halfway into the book before you even get to the first album.
Really?
There's a chapter each on their like own personal like childhoods, you know, the various members of the band. Certainly Joe, Mick and Paul. And then there's just a lot about all the build up to where they even became a band. So, you know, the 101ers and all that stuff
Mick's,
The Delinquents was the band he was in.
I think something like that.
Called. Yeah. They had like those two in particular had whole histories, you know, of being in other bands and stuff like that before the Clash formed. And you get a lot of background on just, you know, what became that punk scene in London. There's a lot of background on that because the Clash had a lot of interactions with the members of the Sex Pistols and so on.
Yes.
I mean, they hung out together. These guys were like mates, as you would say. You know what I mean? They, their manager, Bernie Rhodes, was a protege of Malcolm McLaren. And, you know, there's a lot about London and sort of the emergence of these, like, you know, the fashion culture there, which is really interesting. This is called Passion is a Fashion, which was a phrase that Joe would use to sort of turn it on its head. But you know that, like how big that was there, those boutiques and everything and all that stuff. And it was a place where people like hung out. And so there's just a ton of background. So if you really want to go deep on like what all these factors that came to put this band together. And then the other interesting thing, too, is and this gets alluded to a lot, is that as much as people sort of mocked the Sex Pistols for being from a manufactured band, right? That, you know, Malcolm McLaren sort of got the pieces and put them together, right? There's a lot of indications here that the Clash are pretty similar in that regard. Like,
really,
you know, Bernie Rhodes did, you know, some of the same kind of stuff. It was basically Bernie started working with Mick. So Mick, after he got kicked out of this band, The Delinquents, this one I thought was a great little insight. He spent, I don't know, months or something like that, just practicing his guitar like insanely, like a freak.
Really?
Because he was just like, that is never going to happen to me again. I'm never going to be that guy who's not good enough, who gets kicked out of the band. Right?
Yeah, and interesting. So,
and what you know, if you know anything about Mick Jones, is that he was like sort of the music savant.
He was
in the class,
yeah.
Right? You know, yeah. He was the guy.
He was the guy that knew all the history and everything, apparently, because he was like a big, like he followed Mott the Hoople around or something like that.
So yes.
Crazy.
And he sort of knew everything. He was the one who, you know, was constantly sort of exploring even before. And he ended up becoming essentially their producer. Like, you know, they'd work with other producers, stuff like that. But really, like, it's like Mick was the guy like putting stuff in. He was always learning how recording worked and how to, you know, put all this stuff together. And so a lot of the complexity of the band comes from him. So it's interesting that drive came from, you know, an early failure. It's like, it's a, kind of like the Michael Jordan story of getting cut from his freshman basketball team, right?
Right.
So anyway.
Incredible. Yeah.
But anyway, you get a lot of background. A couple other insights I'll give you by the other band members. You know, Joe Strummer was in the 101ers. There's some stuff floating around. Like, you can hear some of that stuff. Like, they were a popular band in the pub rock scene in Britain. And he was a few years older than the other guys in the Clash. So he had a little bit more history playing. But he knew that band had, like, reached its ceiling. Like, it just wasn't, like, the kind of music they were playing, if, you know, like, that pub rock stuff, it felt, you know, a little bit too retro to ever like really become something bigger. You know, it was always going to have like sort of this crowd of fans, but it was, you know, was it really ever going to grow into anything else? And what he really wanted was some opportunity to sort of combine his love of like Chuck Berry and stuff like that with something that sounded new. And so the interesting thing is that Paul Simonon, who hadn't had zero musical experience, he got picked. So this is where I get to the manufacture part. He got picked because he became friends with Mick. And when Bernie Rhodes saw Paul, he was like, that's the guy who should be in your band.
He's the coolest looking guy there is.
Based totally on looks, right?
Amazing.
So so Mick taught him enough on how to play the bass.
Yep.
To get him going, and did that, and then they basically recruited Joe, the three of them, Paul, Mick, and Bernie, you know, had seen the 101ers and knew Joe, and so you know, basically recruited him to be in this new band, and he was at the right time for him. He was like, yeah, this is I don't see this 101ers really going any further than this,
right?
And even though they were drawing, you know, good crowds and stuff. And then there's a whole lead. I mean, there's really like probably a couple of chapters of just like them from that point and all the kind of like rehearsing that they did and some of the other, you know, things that were happening in terms of songwriting and stuff like that to become what was, you know, what we know as the Clash, right?
Very right.
Interesting stuff. And and Bernie Rhodes, an incredibly interesting character. You get the sense from here that he was insane, you know, just a complete nut. But would they have become the band they were without that sort of, like, there's a lot of evidence here that the chaos is what really drove them and that they may have needed that. And maybe there may be something to that. Like, do you need to achieve like real artistic greatness? You can't just get too comfortable. You got to like challenge yourself all the time.
London's burning. London's burning. All across the town, all across the night, everybody's driving with. Turn it on your face, a new religion. Everybody's sitting around watching television. Let us burn.
We're born on now.
You know, it's I really got to read this because it's illustrative of what you said early on is that I the book I have on the Clash, and I may have talked about this one or just briefly, I don't think I ever did a book nook on it, but it was written by Johnny Green, who was their yes. road manager, right?
Yes.
But it that only covers the London Calling period and slightly after, because he that's the only time he was with them.
I mean, that's right. That's what I mean.
He was their guy. One of his jobs was like to wake Mick up in the morning and get him to practice. But then he was gone at the end of that tour. So
that's the thing.
The only part you get. Yeah.
There's a revolving door of other people because I think they just couldn't stand it very long. It was just too.
It was too intense.
It was too intense and chaotic, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
And the personalities were very strong. So, you know, Joe, Mick, and Paul, all those guys, very strong personalities.
Yep.
And then Topper Hedden, the you know who ends up becoming their like ace drummer. He you know his story is just sad because he just you know devolved into drugs and
yep exactly
and
yep,
and it's
he lost it.
It's really a sad story because you may call him one of the great drummers of all time. You know, he like
yeah.
everybody in here talks about how much talent that guy had. Just insane. And how like even like when they first worked with a real producer, Sandy Pearlman, on their second album, the guy who like recorded like Blue Oyster Cult and stuff like
yep.
that, right?
Yep.
Who they didn't really have a great time working with, by the way, but but nevertheless, he was just gushing about like, oh my God, you know, here I go in to record this punk band, but Topper made it so much easier for me because we could lay down his drum tracks and he would get it like, you know, second take, boom, it's done. You know,
yep.
he was so good. You know, they were doing some really, you know, expansive stuff even by the second album.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Because you know, part of the thing is like Topper could play anything. He could just play anything. So it's really sad that his story. But one other thing I want to say about Paul, I think I even texted you about this, but I thought this was a huge insight and I didn't really know this part of the story that well. Now, I mentioned Paul Simonon didn't have any music background as a musician, but what he did bring to the band, he was more of an artist, like a visual artist type, and they all went to art school. They all did that British, you know, rock band art school thing, like
yep.
the Stones and the Who and all that. Paul in particular really grew up poor and he lived in, some difficult, I guess, tough, I guess you'd say, neighborhoods of West London. Sociologically, I'm not telling you people anything you probably wouldn't understand. These tend to be a lot of neighborhoods where there'd be a lot of immigrants.
Yep.
That lived there, right? He was just immersed in like reggae. Like he,
yeah.
like that was just
yeah.
like in his blood because he listened to it all the time because in his neighborhood, it was like, it wasn't even just like, hanging out with people. It was like just walking down the street. You know, you just hear reggae everywhere, right? So he loved it and he just became just thrilled with it. And all the people, you know, his classmates or whatever, people he hung out with, his friends, you know, were all into reggae. And so others in the band were into it, but he was like the real champion of that style of music. So that's really where the reggae stuff comes from. And as I'm one thing I thought was really interesting in this book was it said that every other, you know, white British band, you know, certainly from the '60s and all of that kind of stuff that was infused with all the like American black music influence, right?
Yeah.
They all got it from records, you know, import records and stuff like that, that would come into their record shops and they'd buy. Paul was getting black music like from actual musicians, you know, who lived
yeah,
in
yeah,
West
exactly.
London, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
like, cause as I mentioned, it wasn't just, yeah, all these guys were, you know, a lot of these guys were players. Right. And so they make the case in this book that the Clash are probably the closest of the like white British bands to black music.
A lot of people won't get no supper tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. The battle is getting hard in this Irish Armageddon time.
running and I'm hiding tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. Remember to kick it off. No one will guide you along in the dark.
Because it takes probably 40% of the book or so before you get to actual like records that you know. It does feel kind of rushed in the second half of the book.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
There's maybe like a chapter on London Calling. There's a chapter on Sandinista, stuff like that. You know, it doesn't feel like it's as deep.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the debut album, it goes pretty deep. The second album, because of the struggles they had. But after that, it feels a little bit more rushed. And I don't know if it's just the author being like, okay, I can't stay at this pace or it's going to be
right.
a 700-page book or something like that. Because it ends up being almost 400 pages, I think.
Oh, wow.
In any biography kind of thing, the most interesting stuff is the struggle. Once you start to get success, it does kind of become less interesting. So there could be a lot of that. He just may not have had his, you know, the material that he got on those years just might not have been as great. And he does focus, even in those years, on the conflicts within the band because, you know, conflict makes for good storytelling again, right?
Always,
so,
yeah.
You know, so, and there were many. They had a lot. They were just strong personalities. But the one guy don't still learn that much about when you get all the way done with this book is Mick Jones.
Is that right?
And people even in the book, the road crew, people, the assistants, his guitar tech was interviewed, all this kind of stuff. All of them pretty much say he was a hard guy to understand.
Is that right?
And,
interesting.
And the author still can't really figure him out. And so, you know, he was just, like I mentioned, you get the musical savant part, you get the fact that, you know, he was sort of the Paul McCartney, I think, of the Clash, in the sense of like he could play anything, he knew all this stuff. He just he was the one who probably had the most kind of sense of drive and determination as far as the band goes, you know, where the band should be going, what they should be doing, you know, keeping it together, all that stuff. But as a person, he was sort of unknowable. You didn't quite understand what made him tick, you know? And I don't even get a great sense that he was even all that much, maybe I'm wrong, but you don't get a sense he was even all that much into a lot of the politics that they were into, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Like, I think he understood that was good, that was on brand for the band, that was what was going to make them work. And Joe wrote, you know, the political stuff for the most part, the lyrics, even if Mick wrote the music to a lot of those songs.
Right.
But you don't get the sense necessarily that he was all that into, that was his passion, right? His passion was the music, I think. And you can even see that in the songs that he wrote that are really credited to him lyrically. They're not that. You know, they're like Stay Free, which is like a song about his like younger days, right?
Yep.
And his friend who went off to prison, at Robin Banks. And then, he wrote Train in Vain, which is a love song. And
there
Should
you
I
go.
Stay or Should I Go, which is sort of a different sort of take on a love song, right? And very kind of like, they describe it here as almost like a Stones kind of song, right? You know, but ultimately at the end of it, when you think about Mick Jones, you know, when the Clash broke up, who was the guy who went on to the most success, right? It was him, right?
And, it was him. Yeah.
I mean, Joe did, all right with the Mescaleros and stuff like that, but it wasn't like Big Audio Dynamite. Big Audio Dynamite was, you know, they sold records. They had a
they
real.
Did.
So all those ideas, all those things that he was working on or wanted to do or had success doing in the Clash and then maybe got reeled back, you know, he was able to just do that on his own, right? And continue to have success with it. And I think, oh, there's a great story in here too. I'll say one other thing. When they worked with Glyn Johns for Combat Rock, because Combat Rock initially was conceived as like another double album, because remember at this point they had done a double album with London Calling, a triple album with Sandinista,
right?
And then their feeling within the Clash, the band members, was like, you know, it was almost like, we can't be contained to a single album. We do all this.
That's
like,
right.
You know, anyway, it was originally going to be a double and they recorded all this stuff, and then it was decided maybe a lot of this stuff wasn't really strong enough to be a double album. And the record label in particular was like, come on, guys, just put out a regular album, you know?
Right.
And so, anyway, they bring in Glyn Johns, who had, you know, worked with The Who and others and was respected by the band. But his job, this was to pare it down. It had all been recorded. He was going to do the mixing and also, you know, basically decide what songs were going to make it and what weren't, yep, and what ones could be shortened, you know, and things, yep, like that, right? So he had that thing. And Mick was really upset about this. And one thing you learned, too, is that over the years in the band, Mick became less dependable and would show up late, things like, yep, that. And he was kind of going off in his own world. There's a great story there about how Glenn Johns was like, okay, I start work at 11 a.m. and we're going to work until like 8 p.m. or something like that. And we're going to work on this and we're going to, you know, wrestle this thing down. So the first day, Joe shows up and Mick doesn't, and they work on it. And they did like three songs or whatever, and they got them, you know, mixed and, you know, like I said, reworked, made some cuts, all this kind of stuff. And then like Mick came in at like 7:30 when they were going to like work till 8 p.m. or something like that. And he heard these songs and he was like, no, I don't like any of it. No,
right,
forget it. And Glenn Johns was like, well, you could have been here at 11 o'clock and I would have listened to all your concerns. But since you weren't here, I'm not going to. We're done, right, with those songs. We're moving on to the next one now. Right.
Yeah, they're going on the record, man.
So I thought that was a pretty telling little story.
That's great. Yeah.
But then the last thing I want to say is about Mick Jones, too, is that, you know, there's a lot of indication here that he was also the guy who really wanted to be the rock star in the,
yeah,
band. Like,
yes,
like Joe, that didn't mean so much to him, or he actually really, over the years, when they did really achieve success, like especially when they got to like combat rock era, it really caused him a lot of inner turmoil because,
yeah,
you know, he was sort of like, how are we supposed to be live up to this, like, sort of like mission statement that they had about what the, you know, all their ideals were and what the band was all about and all this kind of stuff. And then also be like, you know, successful, rich rock stars. Like it doesn't, yep, make sense. It, you know, he even like at a point where he disappeared for like a month or something like that. He had to like sort of find himself. Mick was always like the guy who wanted to be the rock star, but I'll say this about him to his huge credit. When he actually got that opportunity with Big Audio Dynamite, right? So here he has total control,
right?
He do what he wants, right? He did some really challenging music. He didn't,
yeah,
just
he
go
did
out there and write, no, more like "Should I Stay or Should I Go" riff rock kind of stuff. You got to give him huge credit for that as an artist. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And as we mentioned, Big Audio Dynamite did have some success, but they were not like a stadium band or some kind of,
no,
big thing like that.
No.
You know, they weren't an Oasis or a U2 or anything.
You know what you said is such an interesting point too. Joe almost with his post Clash stuff almost in a little sense went sort of back toward the 101ers, right? But Mick,
right,
went in the other direction with Don Letts coming in and,
yeah,
and yeah, it was more of like something to be played in clubs or, you know,
right. If the Clash had stayed together, if Mick and Joe had stayed together, where would they have gone from combat,
yeah,
rock? There was really almost a feeling like, where do you go from here? Like
straight to hell.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm not sure I have an answer for that other than maybe I think Mick's path was probably the way to go to get like even weirder and really embrace,
yeah,
like these more contemporary sounds. I mean, he got into all the sampling and the,
yeah,
drum loops and all that kind of stuff.
A very good point. I want to go read this book right now. I mean, it sounds great. I love, I need all that background build up too. I can't wait.
It's very detailed, like I said, even to the point where you sometimes have to like try to remember,
yeah,
you know, like I said, who this person was or what are they,
right,
referring to or that kind of stuff. It's a very complicated story, the Clash is, I think. And I think that's part of what makes them so great.
Yeah, definitely. It holds tremendous appeal because of that. Yeah.
All right. There you go. Passion is a Fashion.
Beautiful.
The Real Story of the Clash by Pat Gilbert. I recommend
Pat Gilbert.
It's good. I kind of whipped through this thing. I really liked it a lot.
Very good. Jim's Book Nook. Fantastic, man.
I got another one coming up, too. I'm almost done with another book. I mean, I'm sort of on a tear lately reading some of these music books. So I'll be back soon.
Can't wait.
All right. So there you go. And here's a good play out for us. Okay.
Okay.
Quick little story. Because of the mention, there's so much about the backgrounds of these musicians before the Clash proper sort of congealed, came together, right? Early in their years, they both brought songs in from their previous bands to, you know, naturally that's what you do. I got these songs.
Right.
Let's do those. Right. So that, like a lot of those early rehearsals, stuff like that, was sort of playing those before they started writing new material that went on the debut album. But, But one song that was mentioned a few different times in this book, to the point where like I had to go, I don't remember ever hearing this. Maybe I had, I don't know. But it was a Mick song called 1-2 Crush on You.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with this song?
Familiar with it, yeah, because it, I think, later was reissued on...
It was.
Yeah, like an anthology or of something.
Right. So the Clash did actually record this song, but it was like only released later, as you mentioned, like on some box set or something like that. So you can hear it. You can find it on the streamings and everything. And I was just like, it got mentioned so many times that I was like, what is this song? So I found it. I don't know that I had ever heard it before. If there is such a thing as a, you know, Clash obscurity, like this is it. It's so interesting. Like I mentioned how Mick's style of songwriting was, you know, maybe a bit different. It's almost like 60s.
Yeah.
It's almost like a Motown song. And it's so much fun. I just, you know, I can see them. I can see it sort of never making the cut for them because it just doesn't quite sound like a Clash song. All right, let's get out of here. If anybody has comments, if you've read this book or just want to comment on the Clash in general,
yeah,
we'd love to hear from you. Call 612-440-1984. Right. Or email rock@suburbspod.com or comment on our Facebook or Twitter or Instagram @suburbspod. All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you all later.
Crush on you. My mind don't need it, but my body do. A little bit of loving and attention from you. Although we're only strangers, they don't need to know. I gotta come clean, I gotta come clean. Ooh, I gotta crush on you. I wanna get serious right away. But I do, I gotta crush on you. What you doing today?
There just has to be new groups, and then that's what you got.